season. Pink immature adults fly high and cover long distances during daytime hours before settling on trees at night. They are very active and their mobility makes it difficult to control individual swarms.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, for more analysis on the current situation and future prospects in India, we are joined by Mr. Sanjay Jha, who is an Indian politician, an ex-banker, and the author of the recently published book, The Great Unraveling, India After 2040. Mr. Jha, welcome back to the show. So, for many countries around the world, 2020 would be remembered as a year of health tragedy and economic downfall. How has India been in this situation, and how do you see the handling of this situation?
Well, India has had an equally difficult period. We are a country that battled a very severe pandemic, much against the earlier expectations. And as you are aware, that after America, India has had the highest number of cases of infections of coronavirus. It has been, a challenge because of our weak public health infrastructure. And the fact that, you know, in the urban cities of India, there's high density of population. So large sections of people were affected very, very negatively. While there has been a significant improvement over the last couple of weeks, we are still, I would say, at this point of time, in the process of trying to overcome what has been a very formidable challenge. Fortunately, I do believe that at the end of the day, the people of India, the society, have risen collectively together to exercise better discipline. We could have done better, but one cannot deny that there has been good public consciousness. And I would say that the central government and the state governments have at least taken it in a very, very serious intent. And to that extent, at least I'm optimistic that going forward, India should be able to contain the virus in the coming weeks, especially now that the vaccine is down the corner.
India has gone through a severe pandemic indeed. And as you said, things might improve. So, some of the government's nationwide plans for privatization were greeted by nationwide demonstrations and protests, the latest one being by the farmers. Why is it like this?
Well, the fact is that the coronavirus pandemic resulted in a massive contraction of India's GDP by 23% in the first quarter, which was perhaps the worst in the entire universe. It has come down since, but we are still battling a serious economic recession. There are protests by the farmers who are very upset with the new laws. There is a lot of backlash even against labor reforms. And the reason behind that is very straightforward. India has still 22% of people living below the poverty line. That works out to almost over 300 million people. And the pandemic has worsened inequality. There has been a concentration of financial and economic resources in the hands of a few, especially the big tech companies, and large, too big to fail companies. So India is actually seeing a major backlash from those who live, as they say, at the borderline. And the farmers' protest is a manifestation of a very serious crisis of inequality, poverty, and a social inequity in our system.
Mr. Jha, before continuing, let's just take a quick look at how the global media has covered the situation.
Migrant flight has serious implications on the already fragile rural health infrastructure. It is estimated that between 2 million and 10 million migrants were impacted by COVID-19. A severe impact on other health programs due to COVID-19 is also evident from the analysis of the National Health Mission data on inpatient and outpatient treatment. Between 100,000 and 200,000 children missed routine vaccinations during February and March. Treatment for tuberculosis also showed declines. Despite the rapidly rising numbers, India has reopened gyms, most workplaces and markets. Given that India has administered only 60 million tests so far, the majority of its population may yet contract the virus. But New Delhi's approach seems to prioritize protecting livelihoods, a choice perhaps influenced by the release earlier this month of quarterly data showing a 24% contraction of India's economy. Other South Asian countries seem to be faring better than India. Afghanistan, Bangladesh, and Pakistan, countries whose median ages are 10, 2, and 4 years lower than that of India, respectively, have dramatically slowed the spread of the coronavirus and recorded a low number of new deaths. India is 4 times larger in area, 7 times in population, and 10 times in GDP than Pakistan. Yet in the dismal realm of COVID-19, bigger numbers are nothing to boast of. Whereas, India's burden is still rising by 70,000 new cases a day. Pakistan's caseload seems to have peaked 3 months ago. Its daily total of new cases has remained in the mere hundreds since early August. India's economy has also fared far worse. The Asian Development Bank predicts that its GDP will shrink by fully 9% in the current fiscal year, compared with a contraction of 0.4% for Pakistan.
All right, welcome back, Mr. Jha, and thank you to the audience as well for staying with us. So, Mr. Jha, you said that the backlash is coming from the most affected people in terms of equality and in terms of poverty. How long do you think it would take for India to recover from the impacts of the pandemic?
Technically, there are people who believe that we should be able to hit around 0% growth rate in the quarter of January to March of 2021. People are very optimistic that India may even have a V curve in some sectors where recovery is concerned. But if you look at India structurally, in terms of the informal sector, where data is very hard to capture, or the rural sector, the agricultural, shall we say, sector, these are areas where it's not easy to capture the real ground level crisis that we face. For example, the migrant crisis, which became a humanitarian problem, the record unemployment that you cannot really write off at all, it's got progressively worse. MNREGA demands have gone up because there has been a reverse migration. A lot of the SME companies, which were anyway struggling, are finding it very difficult. And please do not forget that India was already struggling on the economy front at a growth rate of around 3 to 3.5% even before the pandemic. So you have seen an aggravation of India's economic woes. Technically, I do believe India might see a GDP growth rate of around 10 to 12% as a bounce back on a lower database. But it would take at least 2 years, in my opinion, for India to begin to get the confidence that we are back in business.
All right. Thank you so much, Mr. Jha, for coming to our show again. It was nice having you here.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Let's see how people on social media see the events that passed 2020.
In the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, Prime Minister Imran Khan, by tweeting this tweet, mentioned the tough choice of the governments of the region in imposing lockdown or not doing so in order to save their economy. Rahul Mukherjee also refers to many poor people and workers who have suffered a lot due to the lockdown and the pandemic. Regarding the November general strike, Rizwan Rahman, as a protester, marks the ruler's brutal and inhuman treatment to workers as the main reason of the protests. And also about the issue of the minority rights, Raimi refers to the important issues such as Islamophobia, the Kashmir conflict, caste atrocities, and the Delhi violence, and considers injustice as an unchanged deep-rooted problem. And at last, Mary Thomas opines the tensions between Muslims and Hindus are actually due more to political factors rather than the religious ones.
And that was our episode about the event that took place throughout the year across the subcontinent. We'll meet next week.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company.
What a dark night. Tonight, the moon is not showing itself, and the stars are shining like lanterns in the sky. Oh, look at there, the Great Bear. And just a little down, there is the Lesser Bear. How beautiful is the sky at night. I am in Maraghe now, a city in East Azerbaijan province. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to visit the Maraghe Observatory. Maraghe Observatory was built during the Ilkhanid era under the directorship of Khaja Nasiruddin Tusi in the city of Maraghe. Khaja Nasiruddin Tusi was an Iranian philosopher, religious thinker, Shia jurisprudent, mathematician and astronomer. Maraghe Observatory was not just a place for observing the stars. It actually used to be a vast scientific organization where the most important branches of science and knowledge were taught. The hill on which the Maraghe Observatory is located has different parts. Some of these parts include the central tower, the library, the residential quarter of scientists, the mosque, the school, the well, and a large workshop for scientists. I am now standing by the Maraghe Observatory on top of a high hill. Here, there are great sceneries as far as the eyes could see. And wow, incredible! The Urumiye Lake is visible from this height. I am now standing by a huge dome, which is wholly covered by a white-colored coating. This coverage is made for protecting the building against the damage caused by rain, wind, and feather destruction. There is also a ladder, which is used for going up the dome. However, I don't intend to go up the dome because I'm acrophobic. Now, let's go inside this magnificent white dome to see what's going on there.
Thank you.
The current monument of Maroghe Observatory is not used for astronomical purposes. Here, the remains of the main building of the observatory is seen. In this place, there used to be a cylindrical tower measuring 22 meters in diameter. One of the other unique characteristics of Maroghe Observatory is its multiple caves and underground corridors. Let's visit there. Oh my God! What a wonderful place! Here, there are several corridors which are connected to each other. Beside these corridors, there are chambers which have steep, triangular ceilings. Just in the middle of these chambers, there is something like a platform. Just imagine! At those times, there wasn't something like telescope, but Iranian astronomers had tools which could observe the stars by them. Until next time, goodbye!
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Some diplomats of the U.S. State Department are reportedly planning to push President Trump out of the Oval Office. This over what they call Trump's incitement of insurrectionist violence against this country. Vice President Mike Pence has not ruled out invoking the 25th Amendment to remove Trump from office either. All this in the midst of growing calls among U.S. legislators to impeach the president following the Capitol riot on Wednesday. Now, some believe this is karma. They argue that Washington has fanned flames all over the world for long years, and it's now paying the price. Some others believe this is the beginning of the end of America. Is this the democracy Washington has always boasted of? Stay with us for a debate.
In less than 2 weeks, Democrat Joe Biden will be sworn in as the 46th President of the United States. But unlike the country's much-touted slogan of peaceful transition of power, nothing within the country seems peaceful. The capital, Washington, D.C., saw unprecedented fatal riots on the Capitol building. It all began after supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump attacked Congress during its meeting to certify Biden's win in the November election. Officials have blamed Trump for inciting the violence as he kept refusing for months to concede defeat. They say U.S. democracy is in danger. President Trump now faces threats of impeachment just days before his tenure comes to an end. House Democrats have already drafted articles of impeachment against Trump over the Wednesday insurrection. The draft was prepared after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called on Trump to resign immediately. She also urged the invocation of the 25th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. The amendment calls for the removal of a president who is unable to discharge his official duties. Trump has been shunned by many members of his own Republican Party as well. President-elect Biden has also called him one of the most incompetent presidents in U.S. history. Outside the country, world leaders, including Washington's allies, have criticized Trump supporters' attack on Capitol Hill.
What we witnessed was an assault on democracy by violent rioters incited by the current president and other politicians. Violence has no place in our societies, and extremists will not succeed in overruling the will of the people.
Britain has reacted too.
President Trump has been saying about that has been completely wrong, and I unreservedly condemn encouraging people to behave in the disgraceful way that they did in the Capitol.
France criticized the Capitol riot, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel blamed Trump for sharing the blame. In Venezuela, President Nicolas Maduro called the violence a reflection of what Washington has been using to do with other countries.
What we see that Donald Trump did, without a doubt, is what they're used to doing with the countries of the world. These same poor rural whites are the ones one sees dressed up as Superman invading Iraq, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, Panama, and Grenada.
The U.S. has always regarded itself as the bastion of democracy in the world. Now, the recent chaotic scenes are seen as undeniable proof of the fragility of democracy there, while they also mark an extraordinary moment in the American history.
Okay, now let's get going with the show. Joining me in this debate will be Frank Emspach, emeritus professor with the University of Wisconsin, also a veteran peace activist out of Madison. And also we have Omali Yeshitela, activist and founder of the Uhuru Movement and also chairman of African People's Socialist Party from St. Petersburg, Florida. Welcome to the show. Let's start with Frank. Some analysts maintain that America's power was already in decline long before Trump took office. In the past 4 years, a further discredited the notion that U.S. should be in charge on the world stage. Let's have your take on that.
Well, I think that the world has become more multipolar in the last 10 years. Clearly, China has become more powerful. Russia has become stabilized and becoming more powerful, and the European Union has also become strengthened. So clearly, there's a shift in the relative power. But the United States military is still the most powerful entity on Earth. Its budget is five or six times the combined budget of all the others. But I think the issue of soft power, of our ability, of the United States' ability to lead, which is what you were alluding to in the introduction, that's another story. And what we saw in Washington on Wednesday, which is the beginning, not the end, it's the beginning of what we're going to see as unrest over the next week, indicates that there is a serious, serious crisis on the moral authority of this country. That is really what the other leaders of the world put in question.
Okay, now let's turn to St. Petersburg. Omali, given the goings-on on Capitol Hill, can Washington lecture others on democracy and human rights?
Well, the truth is Washington should never have been able to lecture other countries on the question of democracy and human rights. And it's only because many peoples around the world, including leaders of other countries and liberals, white liberals, and others in this country, would dismiss or understate the significance of the ongoing historical oppression of African people, the indigenous people in this country. The fact that it is the memory of this country does not include recognition of the genocide that stole this land, this indigenous land that's responsible for thousands of millions of people living in concentration camps that they call Indian reservations. And the reality is that the American Empire started at the moment Europeans came here, took this land, kidnapped African people, and worked us like beasts. And that has never stopped. And even before anything that we're talking about now that happened on January 6th occurred, we were seeing Africans killed, shot down in the streets in this country on a regular basis, or killed in other fashions. We got this huge population of African people locked in the prisons. One out of every 8 human beings on earth who's in prison is an African in the United States. And the fact that this has never been the kind of issue it should be, has never grabbed the attention of the human rights activists in Europe, the great leaders who are now condemning, talking about America pretending to be democratic. The only reason America could pretend to be democratic all those times is because what has happened to African people here has been dismissed. And we talk about America as soft power, but it's the gun that has always been able to influence any narrative, any discussion about America. There was no democracy that was responsible for Mossadegh's overthrow, for Abin's overthrow in Guatemala, just the whole horror, terror that America has waged around the world. So that now what has happened is the political significance, the political power of this country has called into question by what people have just seen with this assault on the Capitol. And I might say, finally, that while January 6th was an attack on the U.S. government, the U.S. government is always making attacks on African people inside this country and various other places around the world. So that's the significance of it to me as the chairman of the African People's Socialist Party.
Okay. Uhuru. Now, Frank, let's take a little glance at a U.S. foreign policy. You see Washington abandoning international agreements and deals, among them, we can say the Paris Climate Accord, the Iran nuclear deal, and these during Trump's term in office. Has this benefited the U.S. or harmed it?
Well, it depends who, you know, and what treaties you're talking about. The United States is still committed to military engagements around the world. The United States, in spite of needling the Europeans, is still committed to NATO. So on the military front, the United States has not pulled back from treaties. On other things, the United States has tried to maneuver the trade treaties and others to the benefit of the top American corporations and industrialists. And so far as I can see, the treaties, the trade treaties and things like that, have undermined the standard of living of most working people. So you have to say who benefits, you know, here with some of these treaties. Who benefits by free flow of capital? Not 95% of the people who have no capital. So I don't think that's a good way to phrase the question. We have withdrawn, the United States withdrawn from treaties that President Trump feels hurts the fossil fuel industry, which is one of his major supporters. So we leave the climate accord. Well, does that help or hurt humanity and this country? It hurts us, obviously, but it helps a segment of the population or of the companies that he's willing to help. So there's always contradictory things here, but mostly the withdrawal from the treaties you're talking about hurts people.
Well, I think it should be also mentioned that most of the treaties that we are talking about, especially that's come under assault with the election of Donald J. Trump, are arrangements that came into existence with the so-called Atlanticist group following the Second Imperialist World War. And where the UN, the NATO, many of the trade agreements were created. And what Trump, and this is something that was done in part to curtail the Soviet Union, to also make it difficult for Germany to be continue as the threat that they had been defined as over the last period. And with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the logic of NATO should have been gone. The point, however, is that there has been a weakening of this and a challenge to the Atlanticist arrangement, and Trump came into power attacking that, attacking the United Nations, attacking NATO, et cetera. And the U.S. Is in a state of decline. There's a certain sector of the rulers in this country and much of what is called the Western world that was connected to the Atlanticist arrangement. That's obviously been kicked asunder.
Now, Frank, the U.S. invaded Iraq on baseless grounds and in violation of international law. It funded ISIS terrorists to oust Syria's President Assad from power. It deployed further firepower to the already tense Persian Gulf region. And the list goes on and on. And the funny thing is it blames others for destabilizing this part of the world. What's the U.S. agenda for West Asia?
Well, again, I think there's more than one agenda. And I think we'll see whether Biden's agenda is going to be as aggressive. Clearly, the United States under Trump shift in its already pro-Israeli position to basically agreeing to whatever Prime Minister Netanyahu wanted to do, based partially on a power politics and partially on a support of a wealthy and right-wing section of the population here. So I don't think it's easy to say that you have the policy. I think right now one of the issues is going to be exactly what policy. Biden is going to be under tremendous pressure, both internationally and also, I think, internally, to pull back a little bit from his pro-Israeli position. There's already, we'll see if it's real, a commitment on the Biden part to meet back with Iran and see if we can restart the treaty again. We'll see. You know, but there's also countervailing pressures, particularly on China, where you have a partially xenophobic and racist attitude towards China, but also clearly there has to be a change in our policy of hostility if we're going to have a stable world. And Biden has to respond to that. Now, hopefully he's going to withdraw from the gamesmanship of the Trump administration, the attacks on China, the arrest of Chinese citizens here when they're doing business, and so forth. We'll see. And that's going to be up to people in this country, it seems to me, to build the kind of movement that says, here is the kind of world we want, and fight for that kind of world. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, President Trump was also blaming his predecessor for, you know, American boots on Afghanistan.
He'll blame anybody. He'll blame anybody. And he's taking advantage of failures in the previous administrations. We never should have been in Afghanistan in the first place. Clearly, the invasion of Iraq was a fraud. And these things were never really dealt with, any more than the real issue of slavery was dealt with here. So, you know, you have these overhanging disasters. And at a Biden administration, if they're going to succeed, if they're going to reach the 72 million people who were in the street who were voted for Trump, they're going to have to do something that clearly responds to some of the anger. And some of the anger is well-placed. We shouldn't have troops all over the world. It's a bad idea. And he has to respond to that.
Yep.
And if he doesn't, I think that we will continue to go down the rabbit hole and really have disaster.
Yeah, we'll wait and see. Now, O'Malley, speaking of international accords and treaties, the U.S. has not ratified such accords like the one on preservation of oceans, whatever related to environment protection. On the rights of women, children, disabled in the states, it has not regulated arms sales and cluster bombs. It has not ratified the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. It left a number of UN agencies. Is America not a member of the international community? Why shouldn't it commit itself to such treaties?
Well, the fact is, America, its agenda is world domination. It always has been. In terms of treaties, I mean, that it makes treaties that facilitates its agenda to maintain world domination and the capitalist social system, which is based on genocide, and it's a parasite. A global parasite that's backed up with tremendous weaponry. And I think that part of what we cannot have this discussion without recognizing is that peoples around the world want to be free. Ultimately, it's not going to be simply up to Israel or up to the United States. I mean, Arab Palestinian people want to be free. Africans in the United States and around the world want to be free. And so I guarantee you that what you'll see moving forward is that the people are going to become a bigger factor in determining how things evolve. It won't just be the United States. It won't be just Biden. Biden is going to make certain kinds of overtures because the capitalists in this country are concerned in part about the kinds of uncertainty that the Trump administration has met, even though he was shoveling trillions of dollars into their coffers on the one hand. On the other hand, it was an element of economic and political uncertainty that they didn't like. Biden is Trump-like. That's why Biden was the Democratic Party response to Trump. He is Trump-like, and he can maneuver more effectively than Trump could. I don't think you're going to see some dressing up of the policies. There are certain policies that are never going to change, essentially, that Trump initiated. The struggle with China, that's going to be here. That's permanent. because there's a real contest, and it's an existential crisis that the United States is confronted right now, just in terms of losing its significance, losing its place in the world, and other countries on the ascendancy, and peoples around the world fighting to take back our resources, our sovereignty, and our dignity. So it's not going to be just something that Trump decides or Biden decides. I'm going to be a part of that decision, as are other peoples around the world who are determined not to live under the boot of U.S. imperialism any longer.
Now, Frank, Omalley spoke of some policy change maybe under the Biden administration. Do you expect to see change in U.S. foreign policy under Joe Biden?
I don't expect a sea change. I expect an amelioration of some things. I expect that we'll be back in the climate treaty and the World Health Organization. There will be an overture towards Iran to try to restart the treaty, but there are obviously questions there where people in the Biden administration want to talk about other things that were not in the treaty, including the missiles and so forth, and preconditions and whatnot, which have already Iran has already said they're not going to do that. We have a treaty, they said, let's enforce it. Well, we'll see if Biden does that. But those are not, that, with possible exception of that, that's not a sea change. A sea change would be a willingness to recognize that we're not going to be in charge anymore. And I don't see that happening any more than the other people on the broadcast do. I do think that it is possible, and it's possible, I'm not saying it's probable, but I'm saying it is possible that with a strong enough movement in this country, we may be able to insist on a less aggressive foreign policy.
Right. Omalley, some observers argue that a U.S. empire is falling apart from within. What's your assessment? What direction is the U.S. heading for?
I mean, I think it may look like it's happening from within, but what we have to remember is the whole capitalist system. The United States is the big dog. It's the hegemon around which everything revolves at this point, even if it's in a shaky position. And so people struggle around the world. I mean, you've got an economy where 80% of the people on the planet Earth are trying to survive off less than $10 a day, 50% of the people on Earth trying to survive off $2.50 or less a day, and that's because of resources that are being stolen, ripped off from other peoples and countries around the world on a stolen land. You've got a settler colony here that's reaching out and stealing people's resources. So people in the process of trying to feed their own children and trying to guarantee a future for themselves are almost always having to go up against the United States and taking back resources. And I think this has contributed to the United States, the economic spiral downward. And then, of course, as has been mentioned, China is a big contender, too. So the United States doesn't have free control in any place in the world, not in Asia, not even in Africa, where China is the fastest-growing economic force inside Africa. The United States and Europe have been the ones who have been able to hold that under their sphere of influence. So the struggles of peoples around the world affect the political situation inside the United States, and in so doing, it affects the political situation. It affects the economic, and doing that, it affects the political situation, because the people who are accustomed to living off the resources from the peoples around the world can't do it anymore. That's an economic problem. That's part of what they happen to deal with.
Okay. On that note, we come to the end of this debate here on Press TV. Let me thank Frank Emspach, Emeritus Professor with the University of Wisconsin and a veteran peace activist from Madison, and also Molly, the Yeshitela activist and founder of the Huru Movement and chairman of African People's Socialist Party from St. Petersburg, Florida.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
On Wednesday, 6th of January 2021, a day the world will not soon forget, hundreds of supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump besieged the U.S. Capitol in a serious attempt to overturn the results of the controversial election of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris as the next president and vice president of the United States. We now present you an article written by Keller Bogills of Bobgo under the heading, "This Is Not Who We Are, Is a Great American Myth." The article has been taken from foreignpolicy.com website. Please stay with us for more of Keller Bogills of Bobgo's article. George Floyd was killed by U.S. police officers in Minneapolis, Minnesota, after allegedly using a counterfeit $20 bill at a neighborhood store. Breonna Taylor was killed in her home by police officers while sleeping in Louisville, Kentucky. Ahmed Aubrey was lynched by a trio of neighborhood vigilantes whilst jogging in Glynn County, Georgia. In 2020, Americans protesting structural racism and anti-black violence with tear gas, pepper spray, pelted with rubber bullets, misrepresented as threats to the public peace, and subjected to arbitrary arrests in cities across the United States. Then, on Wednesday, 6th of January 2021, a day the world will not forget soon, hundreds of supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump besieged the U.S. Capitol building in a serious attempt to overturn the result of the controversial election of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris as the next president and vice president of the United States. After rushing doors, breaking windows, and charging through the halls of Congress, the insurrectionists sat in the Senate president's seat, put their feet up on the House Speaker's desk, ransacked congressional offices, and defaced statues. The consequences? A remarkably small number of arrests and even some selfies with security officers. The recent events reflect a double standard between how law enforcement responds to different groups based on their race. Last year, Black Lives Matter protesters were overwhelmingly peaceful, but were subject to ill treatment by the authorities and smeared as rioters and looters. By contrast, some conservative politicians and news media have denied, excused, and even defended the pro-Trump insurrectionists who attempted to seize the citadel of U.S. supposed democracy and managed to walk away from the scene. Policymakers, academics, and citizens have long decried the discrepancy in the treatment of black people and people of color more generally in comparison to white people in the United States. In policing, employment, housing, healthcare, and many other areas, this inequality has adverse consequences for democracy. It sharpens social cleavages, normalizes the marginalization of certain groups, and limits the full and equal participation of all the peoples in political, economic, and social life of the United States. The anti-democratic behavior and racism that have defined the Trump era should be addressed through transitional justice. First, so that Americans can develop a shared understanding of their political past and present. And second, so that there can be justice for all. Over the last few days, the U.S. media and political leaders have repeated the refrains, "This is not who we are," and "This is not America," again and again. This is not who we are. This is not America. To the contrary, this is in fact and in essence America. But a foundational flaw in the U.S. national project is its citizens' inability to unite around a common understanding of reality, notably in terms of structural racism and systemic injustice. This divide increasingly falls along partisan lines. The recent assault on the Capitol building shows that it is well past time for the United States to confront its troubling past and present. It is well past time for transitional justice to address discrimination, to address violence and abuse of power by government and non-government actors alike. While transitional justice is often applied by governments in new democracies and post-conflict countries, the framework could prove valuable in the United States, which has a long list of unaddressed violence and abuse, generally connected to racism and other systems of oppression. Transitional justice can help the United States address two pressing issues simultaneously, that is, anti-democratic behavior and historical and contemporary racism. Donald Trump and his enablers catalyzed the anti-democratic riot at the Capitol after months of peddling claims about illegal votes, faulty voting machines, and ballot theft and disposal. Ethnic antagonism among many Republicans underlies these attacks. Republicans are overwhelmingly white, report being concerned about the growing presence and political power of Americans of color and their demands for a more free, more just and equitable society. In a national survey conducted in January of 2020, political scientist Larry Bartels found that 51% of surveyed Republicans believe that the traditional American way of life is disappearing so fast that they may have to use force to save it. 47% agreed that strong leaders sometimes have to bend the rules in order to get things done. And 41% agreed that a time will come when patriotic Americans have to take the law into their own hands. These figures may be even higher now. Transitional justice could address these beliefs in part by punishing those who have taken the law into their own hands and deterring those who would do so in the future. As part of a transitional justice response to anti-democratic actions, elected U.S. officials must dispense with theories of election fraud, and those who have encouraged them should be held accountable under the law. When the Democratic-controlled Congress convenes after the inauguration on 20th of January, it should begin hearings on election disinformation. All federal office holders who contributed to election disinformation and who incited violence, including Donald Trump, and the 147 Republicans who voted to overturn the election, should be served with congressional subpoenas that compel them to testify under oath at risk of perjury to the purported truth. The 2020 election was safe, it was secure, and free and fair. Their constituents should hear the truth from them directly. Should subpoenaed individuals fail to comply or lie under oath, the punishment is very simple. They should be indicted and tried for obstructing justice and lying to Congress. Wednesday, 6th of January's insurrectionists and all who engage in similar violent acts with the intention to upend the so-called democracy should also be arrested, charged, and tried. Otherwise, Americans will likely see similar assaults on democracy in the coming weeks, months, and years. The U.S. Congress should also seek to curtail presidential pardon powers so that leaders cannot pardon themselves, their relatives, or their close associates. Self-serving pardon powers have become a definite feature of the Trump administration, and many Trump allies are banking on being pardoned for misdeeds carried out in his service. Second, to confront America's racist past and present, the country could turn to a truth commission, such as one sponsored by Representative Barbara Lee and Senator Cory Booker, to establish certain basic facts for the nation. Systemic inequality is a defining feature of American democracy, as is white privilege. Both explain disparities in U.S. political, economic, and social life, including how demonstrators are portrayed and treated by law enforcement officers. Whether through a truth commission or through another set of congressional hearings, the United States must dispense with whataboutism and a false equivalencies drawn between social movements such as the Black Lives Matter movement and the rioters at the Capitol. It is essential to clarify that whilst the Black Lives Matter promotes racial equality and inclusion, Donald Trump's Make America Great Again movement focuses on white supremacy and on exclusion. Last summer's Black Lives Matter protesters were lawful and motivated by noble goals such as ending police brutality and impunity for perpetrators of racial violence. The pro-Trump insurrection, though, was at its core violent and illegal, and it was motivated by an ignoble goal: undermining democracy and subverting the will of an increasingly diverse people. The Biden administration and the new session of Congress must quickly counter the attacks on democracy and on marginalized groups that have characterized the Trump presidency. The time for truth and the time for justice is right now.